Before long, we'll be where it would have taken mankind millions of years of learning to reach.
And what will Mitchell learn on getting there? Will he know what to do with his power?
That's the big agenda here, is undermining the whole idea of journalism, and that's the real thing to worry about.
The good old Ministry of Truth has another outlet.
Too often, broadcast radio insults your intelligence instead of respecting it, improving it, challenging it. But not here. Where knowledge is power, this is Powerful Radio. This is 30 minutes of information and inspiration. This is the Ministry of Truth. Hello and welcome to the Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Szczepańczyk. On today's show, we'll feature an interview with Corey Fisher Hoffman of the Prometheus Radio Project to discuss efforts to improve American radio using the tool of low-power FM and the progress of congressional legislation toward that end. We'll also hear a commentary from the website Black Agenda Report. But now, a collection of news about media and democracy from the show Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
The Federal Communications Commission has announced plans to create stronger open internet rules. And the fight over network neutrality, the longstanding principle that keeps information flowing freely online, has been reignited, with opponents of net neutrality increasingly resorting to misinformation and spin. To counter those arguments from big phone and cable companies and their hired front groups, Free Press has released a new report called Digital Deja Vu, Old Myths About Net Neutrality. It exposes false claims net neutrality opponents are making about investment, regulation, competition, and other prevalent issues. Derek Turner is the research director of Free Press.
The reason we wrote this paper was to alert people in the debate that a lot of the talking points coming out against net neutrality are simply old and long discredited talking points, that this ground was tread years ago when the net neutrality debate first started in 2005 and 2006, and even the providers themselves have moved on from some of these arguments.
With phony grassroots groups and industry lobbyists smearing net neutrality on the airwaves, on the internet, and in newspaper op-ed pieces, Turner wanted to set the record straight.
The sky is not falling. We're not talking about some type of radical, new, heavy-handed regulation of the internet. What we're talking about is preserving something that's always existed, which is basic rules of the road that prevent incumbent internet service providers from discriminating. These aren't new regulations. In fact, the internet was born under a regime of non-discriminatory protections. The internet as we know it today wouldn't exist if it wasn't for regulation.
If the internet is not protected, users will begin to see changes in the way their connections work. Turner says that without net neutrality, peer-to-peer file sharing will be a thing of the past. Telephone applications like Skype will slow to a crawl or disappear, and your favorite sites may load very slowly or not at all. Laptops could be locked down, much like mobile phones are today. They'll come preloaded with software that only works on one network, that will only access certain sites.
These carriers' mindset is so backward and so closed, and so focused on monetizing everything that flows across their network, that they think that's what consumers want, and that's certainly what they want because it helps prop up their stock price. They're very short-term focused, and they don't see the bigger picture. They don't see that an open internet with unlimited applications and that's evolving at a rapid pace is actually good for their own businesses. It makes consumers value the connections more. It gets more people on the network, and it actually makes them a ton of money.
To read Digital Deja Vu, go to freepress.net.
Last week at the museum in Washington, D.C., the Knight Commission on the Information Needs of Communities in a Democracy released an extensive new report on the information needs of citizens in the 21st century. Informing communities, sustaining democracy in the digital age was the product of 18 months of work and numerous hearings, panels, and interviews. The Knight Commission included 17 commissioners from diverse backgrounds and across the political spectrum. Commission co-chair Theodore Olson, the former U.S. Solicitor General, expressed how inspired he was by the creativity and innovation that is taking place every day.
We put a lot of attention into the fact, what do communities need? What is the array of things that communities can use to judge themselves? Those community citizens in those communities can judge how their communities are doing, to evaluate the access to information and how it gets to them and what types of information and what channels of communication they need so that they can put pressure on the leaders of their community to do something about it.
Former FCC Chairman Michael Powell said that democracy is organized around geography. In this age of virtual reality and distance overcome by digital technology, we often overlook the significance of physical surroundings, our roads, schools, local economies, and community centers.
There's two kinds of information. We focused on both what you need to be a civic participant in order to be an active member and in a vibrant democracy, but we also understand there's no way to do that if the personal life-enhancing needs that you need on a day-to-day basis, when my family wakes up at 6 o'clock, what does it have to know at 6:01 and moving forward?
The commission proposed three basic steps for creating a stronger information system. First, the creation of universal broadband access for all Americans through a national digital broadband infrastructure. Second, the creation of a national policy to help people engage with the information and use it to help build stronger communities. And third, finding sustainable models for supporting the kind of journalism that informs Americans of the world they are living in. To read the report, Informing Communities, go to nightcom.org. That's KNIGHTCOMM.org. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
And now, a commentary from the website Black Agenda Report.
For the poor, the Olympics is like Russian roulette. If your city is chosen to host the games, it's time for you to start looking for somewhere else to live. The people of Chicago dodged that bullet last week, and now the poor residents of Rio de Janeiro have until 2016 to figure out how they'll survive the world's biggest traveling urban redevelopment machine, posing as an athletic event. Losing the Olympics was a victory for the plurality of Chicagoans who didn't want the honor anyway. Not that the Windy City ever stood a chance. If American corporate media cared anything about elementary journalism, they would have discovered that Chicago was way down the Olympic delegates' list of places to go. If the truth be known, ever since 9/11, the United States has had a reputation of not being very hospitable to foreigners. Gentrification is moving along at a steady clip in Chicago without the boost of Olympic madness. Back in 1996, Atlanta wound up showing its backside to the nation and the world, arresting 9,000 homeless residents and displacing as many as 30,000 poor people, many of whom had to leave the city entirely. Now, Atlanta's black elite has taken a look around and discovered that the shrinking African-American base of population might not be sufficient to keep a black mayor in office. Gentrification and black power don't mix. Now the poor people's push-out machine is bound for South America, which has never had an Olympic experience. When Brazil got thumbs up this time around, there was dancing in the streets of Rio, but that's nothing new. Much of Rio de Janeiro is so desperately poor, they've got to dance just to keep from crying. As many as 2 million people, one-third of the population, live in the hillside shantytowns called favelas, places the police treat like enemy territory, and where residents build houses with cement walls 6 inches thick to stop bullets. There's nothing Rio's elite would like better than to send the favela residents someplace far, far away, and the powers that be can be counted on to undertake Olympian efforts towards wholesale favela removal between now and 2016. In fact, 2016 is 2 years too late, since Rio is hosting the World Cup soccer games in 2014, so the clock is ticking on the city's poor. The war against the heavily black favelas has always been ugly. The city recently resorted to building walls around the shanty towns. Ostensibly, the walls are designed to protect the tropical forest, which is indeed endangered by all those poor people spilling up the sides of the mountains overlooking the city and the sea. But everyone knows the wall's real purpose is to fence the poor in. Some critics are comparing the favela walls to the walls Israel has built to confine the Palestinians. The Olympics are advertised as agents for peace, understanding, and human fellowship. In the real world, the games are occasions for world-class real estate deals and expulsion of the poor and the powerless. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
You're listening to The Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stepanchik. We now feature an interview with Corey Fisher Hoffman of the Prometheus Radio Project to discuss efforts to improve American radio using the tool of low-power FM and the progress of congressional legislation toward that end. The following interview took place via cell phone on the afternoon of Thursday, October 8, 2009. We are joined on the telephone with Corey Fisher Hoffman. Corey Fisher Hoffman is the campaign director of the Prometheus Radio Project out of Philadelphia. And Corey, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Let's get some basics. The Prometheus Radio Project, for listeners who may be unfamiliar with the project, explain briefly what it is and what you do there.
Sure, absolutely. Well, the Prometheus Radio Project formed back in 1998 as a small collective of West Philly activists who had run a pirate radio station, which means an unlicensed radio station, and the FCC had actually come and shut down the station. So in really fighting for legal access to the airwaves for similar activists and community organizations across the country, the Prometheus Radio Project was formed shortly after Radio Mutiny was cut off the air, and along with a number of other organizations around the country fought for legal access to the public radio spectrum and helped to create the service Low Power FM Radio.
And this, we're recording this on Thursday, October 8th, about noon Central Time, 1 p.m. Eastern Time. And there was a press release that I received with the headline, Low Power Radio to Clear Hurdle in Congress, Local Community Radio Act scheduled for vote. And the vote took place today. Two brief questions. One, what is the Local Community Radio Act and what does it do? And two, what happened at the vote?
Sure, absolutely. Well, the Local Community Radio Act is a really important piece of legislation that removes unfair restrictions that were placed on the service of low-power radio, which was created back in 1999. The restrictions that were placed on the service were done because big broadcasters didn't like that local community organizations, neighborhood groups, churches, schools, nonprofits could actually use a part of the public spectrum for their own radio stations. And so the big broadcasters headed to Congress and said, these local, tiny, 100-watt stations are going to cause waves and oceans of interference on our huge, hundreds of thousands of watts, full-power radio stations. Congress then limited the service by placing restrictions and kicking low-power radio stations out of urban areas by limiting what's called the third adjacency, or three clicks away on the dial to a full-power radio station. Congress also said that the FCC had to do a study to look into this technical issue of interference. A study came out by the MITRE Corporation in 2003 to show conclusively that interference is not an issue, and since then the Prometheus Radio Project, along with numerous other media reform, civil rights, and grassroots organizations, have been fighting to remove those restrictions through a piece of legislation called the Local Community Radio Act. The subcommittee hearing on communications technology and the internet, that's chaired by Representative Boucher from Southwest Virginia, took place today, and this was a huge hurdle that we've overcome in the many years that we've been working to try to pass this legislation. We've cleared out of the Senate Commerce Committee, but we've never been able to make significant progress out of the House. With the subcommittee markup today, we've been able to successfully move this legislation out of the subcommittee into the full Energy and Commerce Committee, where Chairman Waxman, who's a longtime low-power FM supporter, is hopefully going to move this legislation along swiftly to a House floor vote, and then we've just got to push it out of the Senate, and we're going to see an opportunity across the country for hundreds and potentially thousands of more low-power FM radio station licenses.
What's the timetable here? Are we looking like maybe at the end of the year when this could actually happen, or what?
Well, you know, there's a new Congress every 2 years, and so we're in a situation where this legislation must pass before next fall. So we have about a year window to continue to push this. This was the biggest hurdle that we faced, is just really moving this out of subcommittee and trying to get the prioritization of this really important issue in the era of climate change and healthcare and so many other issues that are, of course, absolutely extraordinarily pressing. So it was a huge accomplishment to move this along, and we're continuing to push hoping to really get this out of the House this fall, and if not this fall, in the springtime, and continue to push forward and get this to the president's desk, who Barack Obama himself was actually a co-sponsor of this legislation as a senator last year.
Let's assume for the moment, as it sounds like that there is momentum and inertia to believe, and reason to believe, that this becomes law sometime within the next year. What would happen then? So that means that I could apply for a radio station, or other groups could apply for a radio station. Explain the process thereafter, should this become law.
Sure. Well, what this legislation will do is it will actually grant power back to the FCC to issue licenses for low-power FM radio stations at the third adjacency, so three clicks away on the dial from a full-power radio station. That would open up the opportunity in rural areas, in some cases, for not only one license to become available in a certain area, but in some cases, two, three, potentially even four low-power radio station opportunities there. As well as for the first time in urban areas, there's only one low-power FM radio station in one of the top 50 markets in Richmond, Virginia, and that's the only one low-power radio has been forced out of urban centers. So what we would see is a process where the FCC would have to open a filing window where community organizations that must be nonprofit, non-commercial, and they have to be organizations, not individuals, can include churches, can include local governments, will apply directly to the FCC for licenses. And some of the things that the FCC that will look for is they will want to make sure that this is truly a local community group, that it's actually non-commercial, that they're based where they say they're based. Organizations can only hold licenses to one station, so you can't have one group sucking up all of the licenses in a state or across the country. And showing that you're really going to be serving community interests and doing local programming. So these are the kinds of considerations that the FCC will look at when they look into licensing, as well as just what kind of frequency or spectrum is available in any particular area. So we anticipate the FCC has supported the expansion of low-power radio. Their own engineering studies have showed conclusively that they never bought into these issues of interference, and then when working with a private engineering firm, the MITRE Corporation, in 2003, once again, the engineering studies showed conclusively interference not to be an issue. So the FCC has, in a bipartisan way, unanimously supported the expansion of low-power FM radio, and we would see a window coming shortly after the passage of the legislation. So those are the things that we are anticipating, and at the Prometheus Radio Project, we are thrilled to see communities across the country being able to apply for these licenses and really get access to the public's airwaves to use local community radio to serve and address the needs of each community.
You've mentioned that there are a number of community groups that are and have been working with an alliance with the Prometheus Radio Project to pass along this legislation. One group that's here in Chicago, the Chicago Independent Radio Project, or CHIRP for short, has been working very hard not only to advocate for this national scale legislation, but also to try to get a radio station of their own in Chicago. But the problem, at least, that I see, and that it seems the CHIRP folks have confirmed to me, and I'd like to hear your comment about this, is that in big cities like Chicago or Philadelphia, that the opportunities for this, even though they would be expanded, would still be pretty scarce because the radio spectrum is already really saturated, and even opening up this window would not open up much of an opportunity. But what are your thoughts on this?
Well, there's definitely, the legislation itself is only one of the many hurdles. The legislation, the restrictions that we're currently facing in Congress essentially tie the FCC's hands. So passing the legislation would untie the FCC's hands, after which point there's still a number of regulations that we need to work to get passed at the FCC so that there can be more options for communities like Chicago, for communities like Philadelphia, and at Prometheus, we really think that there is enough room on the airwaves for as many voices as can be heard. And so we are working very hard, not only in Congress, but also at the FCC, to try to get the rules and regulations to really favor local voices going on the airwaves. But you're absolutely correct, and CHIRP is working hard not only to see the passage of this legislation, but to make sure that the FCC acts in favor of groups like CHIRP being able to access the airwaves.
Back in 2000, where we thought that the legislation that was passed by Congress that would authorize the FCC to grant a lot more low-power radio stations than they actually were able to, it's my understanding, maybe correct me if I'm wrong, that the original articulation of the legislation actually projected maybe thousands of low-power radio stations, but yet the opposition, mainly the major broadcast lobby and their lobbyists, or commercial broadcast lobby, I should say, but also an alliance, ironically enough, with National Public Radio, took steps to basically strangle the baby in the crib, to put it one way, to basically change the legislation practically in the dead of night in order to mute the impact of the number of radio stations and the number of community voices that could result from the legislation. Two quick questions. One, is this accounting correct? And two, how do we know that we won't see another shady maneuver that won't appear in Congress in the dead of night that could spoil the moment here?
Sure, absolutely. Well, the assessment that you gave is mostly correct. So a little bit of the history about the creation of low-power FM radio is that it actually wasn't created through legislation. It was created through an act at the FCC, in which the FCC had numerous hearings on the issues of localism and diversity of media ownership. After the passage of the 1996 Telecommunications Act in Congress, there was a huge consolidation and concentration of media outlets. So prior to that, for example, you had Clear Channel potentially owning 40 radio stations across the country. And swiftly after the 1996 Telecommunications Act, which opened up the possibility for corporations and conglomerates to own more and more media, we saw that jump to 1,200 radio stations. So we're talking about a huge change where there's more radio stations, however, there are less corporations, companies, and individuals owning them. So it was in this media landscape that Prometheus was born and demanding public access to the airwaves, and that the FCC really resonated and saw a crisis in localism where communities across the country would tune in their radio dial and they couldn't actually ever hear anything that was produced in their own hometowns. Everything was content piped in from elsewhere. So it was in this context that the FCC decided to create low-power FM radio. However, what you mentioned of this dead-of-the-night change was a congressional act in which broadcasters forced some politicians, and you don't have to push hard because so many of the industry broadcasters make it very clear to politicians about how it is that they get elected, and oftentimes it's, you know, having commercials and making sure that they're featuring them. So as you mentioned, they put in the what's called the Radio Broadcasting Preservation Act into a huge omnibus that had numerous pieces of unrelated legislation, and really amended the service and limited it, as you said, by kicking low-power FM radio stations off of the third adjacency, or three clicks away on the dial from a full-power radio station, pushing it all the way to the fourth adjacency, four clicks away. And that was the restriction that made it so hard for so many community organizations who had already applied for licenses to be able to get them. And there were around 500 licenses that were thrown out directly as a result of those restrictions.
But could we see another shady maneuver with this Local Community Radio Act? Could they pull that off with the Local Community Radio Act is what I'm asking.
Well, the big broadcasters are always there, and we continue to have to face and mobilize grassroots people, community organizations, to really hold our representatives accountable to representing our interests and our views. We saw a vote today of 15-1 in the subcommittee, and even former broadcasters like Representative Walden, ranking Republican Chris Stearns, and numerous other representatives surprisingly really coming out in opposition to broadcasters' continued concerns, despite them being quite discredited from an engineering and technical perspective. So I think that we're seeing a new era when it's just enough is enough and it's time to pass this legislation. Representative Eshoo spoke today at the hearing and she said, "So what I want to say about the Local Community Radio Act is it's about time. People know that it has been a decade-long fight to get this legislation moving. The broadcasters have nothing left to stand on. But of course we have to remain vigilant. Of course there is so much money and power in politics, and we know that we're the little guys really fighting for a slice of justice within all of this. So I think it's important to stay vigilant. We are not going to count our eggs or chickens before they hatch. We know that we have an uphill battle to fight, but we really see exciting progress, and as Representative Eshoo said, it's now is really the time.
Let me let me wrap things up with the impact about this within the terrain of like larger corporate commercial radio and actually larger media generally. In the past year or so, we've seen reports, and I've certainly read a lot of the media business press, that show that major television broadcasters, radio certainly, a lot of media that previously had been cash cows are now turning into money pits, that profits have just sunk tremendously, mainly because advertising has just gone downhill at rates of maybe 20 to 40%, which it would seem to me might reduce a lot of the potential power that a lot of these major media corporations wield, and thus also perhaps open up doors of opportunity that community groups like Prometheus and allied groups might be able to foster. What's your assessment of the situation there? And you think I'm on the right track, or am I Pollyanna here?
No, I mean, I think that you make some really good points, and one of the organizations that we collaborate with strongly in the passage and the fight to pass this legislation is Free Press, and they've done a lot of work around the crisis in journalism, around the crisis in media, really. And so a lot of the points that you bring up are absolutely true and something that could create an opportunity. I think also what's different now as opposed to in 2000 when we were fighting the industry is now we have 10 years of really powerful stories about low-power FM radio stations that exist. Then the service was just a theory. It was the creation of a license, but not a single low-power radio station was on the air. And so now we have these incredible stories of low-power radio stations saving lives in the face of hurricanes, these amazing stories about farm worker organizations who have low-power FM radio stations in which they're transmitting not only in Spanish or Haitian Creole, but in Ma, Quiche, Cachiquel, Mixteco, a number of indigenous languages of farm workers. We have these examples of local community radio stations that are serving the needs and interests of their communities in ways that commercial radio stations never could because their programming just simply isn't profitable. That's not why they're designing their programming. They're actually designing their programming to meet the needs of their community. So in addition to there being questions about what role corporate broadcasting is playing these days, there's also powerful stories and examples that in my many meetings with congressional representatives and their staff, is really the most compelling part of the story, which is how different communities use local media as a way of addressing local issues, as a forum for debate and discussion, and as a place to really share information, especially in instances of crises.
We've been speaking with Corey Fisher-Hoffman. She is the campaign director of the Prometheus Radio Project out of Philadelphia, and she's been talking with us about low-power FM radio broadcasting, in particular the Local Community Radio Act, which just passed out of committee. Corey, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much.
That was an interview with Corey Fisher-Hoffman, recorded on October 8, 2009. To learn more about low-power FM radio and the Prometheus Radio Project, go online to www.prometheusradio.org. Prometheus Radio is spelled Prometheusradio. Listen to all past episodes of the Ministry of Truth online at www.szcz.org. That concludes this episode of the Ministry of Truth. Special thanks to Mario and the staff of WHPK Radio in Chicago. Thank you for listening.